out among her stars. For Shaver's head rested on Joshua's chest, her river-washed hair against his cheek. Do not think that because our wedding was foreshortened it meant any less to me, he said finally. I promise you that one day we will have our lives back as they were meant to be. You shall be the lady of a great house, not an exile in the wilderness. Gods of my clan, you are a fool, Joshua, she said. Do you think that I care what kind of house I live in? She turned and kissed him, wriggling closer against his body. Fool, fool, fool. Her breath was hot against his face. They spoke no more. The stars gleamed in the sky, and the river sang to them. Daonoth awakened just after dawn to the sound of Leleth crying. It took him a moment to realize why that seemed so strange. It was the first sound he had heard the child make. Even as the last shreds of dream fell away, he had stood before a great white tree whose leaves were flames. He was clawing for the hilt of his sword. He sat up to see Duchess Guttrun holding the little girl on her lap. Beside her, Father Strangyard had poked his head, tortoise-like, from beneath his cloak. The priest's wispy red hair was dew-dampened. What is it? Daonoth asked. Guttrun shook her head. I don't know. She woke me up with her crying, the poor thing. The Duchess tried to cradle Leleth against her breast, but the child pulled back. She continued to cry, her eyes wide open, staring at the sky. What's the matter, little one? What's the matter? Guttrun crooned. Leleth tugged her hand free from the woman's embrace, and tremblingly pointed toward the northern horizon. Daonoth could see nothing but a black fist of clouds in the most distant part of the sky. Is something out there? He asked. The child's cries died away to hiccuping sobs. She pointed again at the horizon, then turned away to huddle in Guttrun's lap, face hidden. It's just a bad dream, that's all, the Duchess soothed. There now, little one, just a bad dream. Joshua was suddenly standing before them, Nadel unsheathed in his hand. The prince wore nothing but his breeches. His slender frame gleamed pallidly in the dawn light. What is it? He demanded. Daonoth pointed to the darkened horizon. The child saw something there that made her cry. Joshua stared grimly. We who saw Naglamund's last days would do well to pay attention. That is an ugly knot of storm clouds. He looked around at the wet grasslands. We are all tired, he said, but we must make a faster pace. I do not like the look of that storm any more than did the child. I doubt we will find any shelter on these open plains until we reach Jaloe's Stone of Farewell. He turned and shouted to Isorn and the others, who were just waking up. Saddle up! We will break our fast as we travel. Come, there is no longer such a thing as a simple storm. If I can help it, we will not be caught by this one. The river valley continued to deepen. The vegetation began to grow thicker and more lush. The sparse meadowland now broken by freestanding groves of birches and alders, as well as thickets of strange trees with silvery leaves and slim trunks deep furred in moss. The prince's party had little time to admire this new greenery. They rode at a fierce pace all day, stopping only for a brief rest in afternoon, then continuing on until long after the sun had dropped behind the horizon, and twilight had sapped the brightest colors from the land. The threatening storm clouds now obscured much of the northern sky. As the rest made a circle of stones and built a healthy blaze, firewood was now in broad supply. Daonoth and Isorn took the horses down to the river. At least we are no longer on foot, Isorn said, uncinching the buckle on a set of saddlebags, which slid to the grass with a soft thump. That is something worth thanking Aiden's goodness for. True. Daonoth patted Veldalix, The drops of perspiration on the horse's neck had already chilled in the evening breeze. Deornoth rubbed him dry with a saddle blanket, before moving on to Joshua's horse, Vinya Fudd. "We have precious little else to be thankful for." "We are alive," Isorn said reprovingly, his wide face serious. "My wife and children are alive and safe with Tornrud in Skogi, and I'm here to protect my mother." He pointedly avoided mentioning his father, Iskrimnor, from whom there had been no word since the Duke had left Naglamund. Deornoth said nothing, understanding the worry Isorn must feel. He knew well the love his Rimmersman friend felt for the Duke. In a way, he envied Isorn, and wished his feelings for his own father could be so admirable. Deornoth was unable to fulfill God's command for sons to honor their sires. Despite his knightly ideals, he had never been able to feel anything but the most grudging respect, and no love whatsoever, for the pinch-souled old tyrant who had made Deornoth's boyhood a misery. "Isorn," he said at last, considering, "someday, when things are as they were before all this happened, and we are telling our grandchildren about it, what will we say?" The breeze blew harder, making the willow branches slap together. His friend did not respond. After a moment, Deornoth stood up and looked across Vinyafod's back to where Isorn stood a few ells away, holding the horse's reins as they drank from the river. The Rimmer's man was only a faint silhouette against the purple-gray evening sky. "Isorn? Look to the south, Deornoth," he said, his voice strained. "There are torches." Away across the grasslands, back down the Steflod in the direction from which they had come, a swarm of tiny lights moved across the land. "Merciful Aiden," Deornoth groaned. "It is Fengbold and his men. They have caught us up after all." He turned and gave Vinyafod a light slap on the flanks, causing the charger to take a few prancing steps forward. "No rest for you yet, fellow." He and Isorn sprinted up the bank toward the wind-whipped flames that marked their camp. "And they are less than a league away," Isorn finished breathlessly. "Down by the river. We could see the lights clearly." Joshua's face was composed, but noticeably pale in the firelight. "God has given us a hard test, to let us get so far and then pull the trap shut." He sighed. The eyes of all watched him in fearful fascination. "Well, at least we must kick out the fire and ride on. Perhaps if we can find a thick enough copse of trees to hide in, and if they have no hounds, they may pass us by. Then we can think of what other plan might suffice." As they clambered into their saddles once more, Joshua turned to Deornoth. "We brought two bows as part of our booty from Fakolmage's camp, did we not?" Deornoth nodded. "Good. You and Isorn take them." The prince laughed grimly, brandishing the stump of his right wrist. "I am not much of a bowman, but I think we will have need of a little arrow play." Deornoth nodded again wearily. They rode swiftly, though all the party sensed that they could not do so for long. The Thriving's horses ran gamely, but it had already been a long day's trek before the company had stopped. Vinyafod and Vildelic seemed as though they had several hours left in them, but some of the other mounts were clearly winded. Their riders were scarcely stronger. As his horse moved beneath him, and the moonlit grasslands rolled past, Deornoth could almost feel his will to resist ebbing away, draining like sand through the neck of an hourglass. "We have come 10 times as far as anyone would have dreamed possible," he thought, clinging tightly to the reins, as Vildelix topped one of the meadow downs and plunged down the opposite slope like a boat breasting a wave. "There is no dishonor in failing now. What more can God expect than that we give our all?" He looked back. The rest of the party was beginning to fall behind. Deornoth pulled up on the reins, slowing his charger until he was in the midst of the company once more. God might be ready to reward them with a hero's place in heaven, but he could not give up the struggle while innocents like the Duchess and the child were at risk. Isorn was beside him now, clutching Leleth on the saddle before him. The young Rimmersman's face was a grey blur in the moonlight, but Deonoth did not need to see his friend to know the anger and determination written on his broad features. He looked back once more. For all their haste, the rippling torches had gained ground on them, closing the distance in the last 2 hours, until they trailed the prince's folk by less than a dozen furlongs. "Slow up!" Joshua cried behind him in the darkness. "If we run farther, we will have no strength left to fight. There is a grove of trees atop the rise there. That is where we will make a stand." They followed the prince up the slope. The cold wind had risen and the trees bent and thrashed, branches scraping together. In the darkness, the pale swaying trunks seemed white-robed spirits lamenting some terrible circumstance. "Here," the prince ushered them past the outermost circle of trees. "Where are those bows?" said Deonoth. His voice was flat. "At my saddle, Prince Joshua." Deonoth heard the awful formality echoed in his own tones, as though they all participated in some ritual. He loosed the two bows and flung one to Isorn, who had handed Leleth over to his mother to free his hands. As Deonoth and the young Rimmersman strung the supple ashwood, Father Strangiard accepted an extra dagger from Sangfugl. He held it unhappily, as though he pinched a serpent's tail. "What will Osiris think?" he said mournfully. "What will my god think of me?" "He will know you fought to save the lives of women and children," Isorn said shortly, knocking one of their few arrows. "Now we wait," Joshua hissed. "We stay close together, in case I see a chance for us to run once more. And we wait." The minutes stretched as taut as the bowstring beneath Deonoth's fingers. The night birds had gone silent in the trees overhead, but for one whose eerie whispering call echoed over and over, until Deonoth wished he could put an arrow through its feathered throat. A sound as of distant and continuous drumming began to separate itself from the droning murmur of the Steflod, growing ever louder. Deonoth thought he could feel the ground beginning to shudder beneath his feet. He suddenly wondered if blood had ever been shed in this seemingly uninhabited land before. Had the roots of these pale trees ever drunk of things other than water? The great oaks around the battlefield at the Nock were said to have gorged on blood until their pith was rosy pink. The thunder of hoofbeats rose until it was louder than Deonoth's own heart drumming in his ears. He lifted his bow, but did not bend it, saving his strength for the moment it would be needed. A swirl of flickering lights appeared on the meadow below them. The headlong flight of the horsemen slowed, as though they somehow sensed the prince's folk, hiding in the grove above them. As they reined up, the flames of their streaming torches bobbed upright once more, blooming like orange flowers. "They are nearly 2 dozen," Isorn said unhappily. "I will take the first," Deonoth whispered. "You take the second." "Hold," said Joshua quietly. "Not until I say." The leader got down from his horse, bending to the ground so that he disappeared out of the glow of torchlight. When he stood, his pale, hooded face turned to look up the slope, so that it almost seemed to Deonoth he had sighted them in the fastness of the shadows. Deonoth lowered his arrowhead until it pointed at the cloaked chest beneath the faint moon of face. "Steady now," Joshua murmured. "A moment more." There was a rush and clatter in the branches overhead. A dark shape battered at Deonoth's head, startling him so that the arrow flew free, high above its intended mark. Deonoth shouted in alarm and staggered back, raising his hands to protect his eyes, but whatever had struck him was gone. "Stop!" a voice cried from the trees above, a creaking, whistlingly inhuman voice. "Stop!" Isorn, who had stared in stupefaction as Deonoth swatted at nothing.
"Thing to do with it, too."
Jaloi came out of the trees behind them, marching down the slope and into the circle of torchlight. The witchwoman, Deonoth realized with a start, wore a cloak and breeches that came from his own saddlebag. Her feet were unshod.
"Valada Jaloi,"
Joshua said in wonderment.
"You come unlooked for." "You may not have looked for me, Prince Joshua, but I looked for you. And the good thing that I did, else this night might have ended in bloodshed. It was you that struck me, before I could let my arrow fly, Deornoth said slowly. But how? Time enough for stories later, Jaloey said.
Then kneeled as Leleth pulled free of Gutrun's clutch to run into the wise woman's arms with a wordless cry of pleasure. As she embraced the child, Jaloey's huge yellow eyes held Deornoth's gaze. He felt a shiver travel down his backbone.
Time enough for stories later, she repeated. Now it is time to make a fire. The moon is far along in her journey. If you are on your horses by dawn tomorrow, you will reach the Stone of Farewell before dark.
She looked up at the northern sky.
And perhaps before the storm as well.
The sky was tar black with angry clouds. The rain was turning into sleet. Rachel the dragon, chilled and storm-battered, stepped into the lee of a building on Ironmonger's Street for a moment's rest. The byways of Urchester were empty, but for flurrying hailstones, and a solitary figure carrying a large bundle on its back, as it trudged away through the mud toward Main Row.
Probably leaving for the countryside, carrying all his worldly goods, she thought bitterly. Another one gone. And who could blame him? It's like the plague has run through this city.
Shivering, she set out once more. Despite the vicious weather, many of the doors along Ironmonger Street swung back and forth unlatched, opening to give a glimpse of empty blackness beyond, banging closed with a sound like breaking bones. It was indeed much as if some pestilence had devastated Urchester, but it was a scourge of fear rather than disease that was driving out the city's denizens. This, in turn, had forced the Mistress of Chambermaids to walk the entire length of the Ironmongery district before she could find someone to sell her what she needed. She carried her new purchase under her cloak and against her bosom, hidden from the sight of passers-by, of which there were obviously few. And perhaps, she hoped, somehow also hidden from the eyes of a disapproving god. The irony was that there had been no necessity to walk through the savage winds and deserted streets. Any of several hundred implements in the Hayholt's kitchen would have admirably suited her bill of particulars. But this was her own plan and her own decision. To take what she needed from Judith's cupboards might put the fat mistress of kitchens in jeopardy. And Judith was one of the few castle folk for whom Rachel felt respect. More importantly, it truly was Rachel's own plan. And in a way it had been necessary for her to walk one more time through Urchester's haunted alleyways. It was helping her work up the courage to do what must be done.
Spring cleaning, she reminded herself grimly.
A shrill, un-Rachel-like laugh escaped her lips.
Spring cleaning in midsummer, with snow on the way.
She shook her head, feeling a momentary urge to sit down in the muddy street and cry.
That's enough, old woman, she told herself, as she often did. There's work to be done, and no rest this side of heaven.
If there had been any doubts that the day of weighing out was almost at hand, just as foretold in the holy book of the Aiden, Rachel had only to think back to the comet that had appeared in the sky during the spring of Elias Regnal year. At the time, with the optimism of those days not long past, many had thought it a sign of a new age and a new beginning for Ostenard. Now, it was clear as well water that it had instead prophesied the last days of trial and doom. And what else, she upbraided herself, could such a hellish red slash in the sky mean? It was only blind foolishness that could have made anyone think otherwise.
Well a day, she thought,
peering from beneath her hood the desolate shops of Main Row. "We have all made our bed of pain. Now God will make us lie in it. In his anger and wisdom, he's given us plague and drought, and now unnatural storms. And who could ask for a plainer sign than the poor old lector dying so horribly?" The shocking news had swept through the castle and city below like flame. Folk had spoken of little else for the last week. Lector Annesin was dead, murdered in his bed by some terrible pagans called Fire Dancers. These godless monsters had also set part of the Sankelen Adonitis ablaze. Rachel had seen the lector when he came for John's funeral, a fine and holy man. Now, in this dreadful year of years, he too had been struck down.
"Lord, save our souls. The holy lector murdered, and demons and spirits walk in the night, even in the hayholt itself."
She shuddered, thinking of the sight she had seen from the window of the servants' quarters one night, not long ago. Lured to the window, not by any sound or sight, but rather by some undefinable feeling, she had silently left her sleeping charges and clambered up onto a stool, leaning on the window casement to look out on the hedge garden below. There, amid the shadowy shapes of the hedge animals, had stood a circle of silent, black-robed figures. Almost breathless with terror, Rachel had rubbed at her old and treacherous eyes, but the figures were no dream or illusion. Even as she stared, one of the hooded shapes had turned to look up at her, its eyes black holes in a corpse-white face. She had run back and leaped into her hard bed, pulling the blanket up over her face to lie in sweaty, sleepless fear until dawn. Before this year of derangement, Rachel had trusted her own judgment with the same iron faith she extended to her God, her King, and the sanctity of tidiness. After the comet came, and particularly since Simon's cruel death, that faith had been badly shaken. The 2 days following her midnight vision, she wandered through the castle in a daze, mind only half on her chores, wondering if she had turned into the kind of daft old woman she had vowed to die before becoming. But as she quickly discovered, if the mistress of chambermaids was mad, it was a contagious madness. Many others had also seen such pallid-faced spectres. The diminished marketplace along Urchester's main row was full of whispered talk about the things that walked by night in both countryside and city. Some said that they were ghosts of Elias' victims, unable to sleep while their heads were spiked above the Nearola gate. Others said that Priorates and the king had struck a deal with the devil himself, that these undead hell-whites had thrown down Naglamund on Elias' behalf, and now waited upon his bidding for further unholy tasks. Rachel the dragon had once believed in nothing that Father Dreosan did not include in his catalogue of churchly acceptabilities, and had doubted that even the Prince of Demons himself could bar her way in a pinch, since she had both Blessed Osiris the Ransomer and common sense on her side. Rachel was now as much of a believer as her most superstitious chambermaid, because she had seen. With her own 2 eyes, she had seen the hosts of hell in her castle's hedge garden. There could be little doubt that the day of weighing out was at hand. Rachel was dragged from her brooding thoughts by a noise in the street ahead. She looked up, shielding her eyes from the stinging sleet. A pack of dogs was fighting over something in the muddy road, snarling and baying as they dragged it back and forth. She moved to the side of the road, hugging the walls of the buildings. There were always dogs running loose in Urchester's streets, but with so few people left, they had become wild in a way they had never been before. The ironmonger had told her that several dogs had leaped through a window in Cooper's Alley and attacked a woman in her bed, biting her so badly that she bled to death. Thinking of this, Rachel felt a tremor of fear run right through her. She stopped, wondering if she should walk past the creatures or not. She looked up and down the road, but there was no one else about. A pair of dim figures moved in the distance a couple of furlongs off, much too far away to be of any help. She swallowed and moved forward, dragging the fingers of one hand along the wall, the other clutching her purchase close against her body. As she edged past the struggling hounds, she looked around for an open doorway just to be safe. It was hard to tell just what they were fighting for, since both dogs and prize were splattered with dark mud. One of the curs looked up from the roil of lean bellies and bony haunches, mouth stretched in a tongue-lolling, idiot grin as it watched Rachel pass. The soiled snout and gaping jaw suddenly put her in mind of some sinner condemned to the ultimate pit, a lost soul that had forgotten whatever it had once known of beauty or happiness. The beast stared silently as hailstones pitted the muddy street. Its attention caught once more by the struggles of its fellows, the dog turned away at last. With a snarl, it dove back into the thrashing pile. Tears starting in her eyes, Rachel lowered her head and struggled against the wind, hurrying back toward the hayholt. Guthwulf stood beside the king on a balcony that overlooked the courtyard of the inner bailey. Elias seemed in an unusually cheerful mood, considering the unimpressive size of the crowd that had been brought into the hayholt to watch the mustering out of the Erkingard. Guthwulf had heard the rumors that passed among his fighting men, stories of the night terrors that were emptying the halls of the hayholt and the houses of Urchester. Not only had comparatively few folk appeared to see the king, but the mood of those gathered was restive. Guthwulf did not think he would like to walk unarmed through such a crowd, while wearing the sash that proclaimed him King's Hand. "Damnable weather, isn't it?" Elias said, his green eyes intent on the milling riders, who laboured to hold their horses in place beneath the pelting hail. "Hardly cold for Anatole, don't you think, Wulf?" Guthwulf turned in surprise, wondering if the king made a strange joke. The upside-down weather had been the chief topic of conversation throughout the castle for months. It was far, far more than oddly cold. Such weather was terrifyingly wrong, and had added in no little part to the Earl's feeling of impending disaster. "Yes, sire," was all he said. There was no longer any question in his mind. He would lead the Erkingard out, as Elias requested, but once he and the troops were beyond the king's immediate reach, Guthwulf himself would never return. Let heedless, criminal idiots like Fengbald do the king's bidding. Guthwulf would take those Erkingards who were willing, along with his own loyal Utanyitas, and offer his services to Elias' brother Joshua. Or, if the prince's survival were nothing more than rumor, the Earl and those who followed him would go someplace where they could make their own rules, out of reach of this fever-brained creature who had once been his friend. Elias patted him stiffly on the shoulder, then leaned forward and waved an imperious hand. Two of the Erkingard lifted their long horns and played the muster call, and the 100 or so guardsmen redoubled their efforts to form their bulking mounts into a line. The king's emerald dragon banner whipped in the wind, threatening to pull free from its bearer's grasp. Only a few of the watching crowd cheered, their voices all but buried by the noise of wind and pattering sleet. "Perhaps you should let me go down to them, Majesty," Guthwulf said quietly. "The horses are anxious in this storm. If they bolt, they will be among the crowd in a moment." Elias frowned. "What? Do you worry about a little blood beneath their hooves? They are battle-bred. It will not harm them." He turned his gaze onto the Earl of Utanyit. His eyes were so alien that Guthwulf flinched helplessly. "That is the way it is, you know," Elias continued, lips spreading in a smile. "You can either grind down that which stands before you, or else be ground down yourself. There is no middle ground, friend Guthwulf." The Earl bore the king's glance for a long moment, then looked away, staring miserably at the crowd below. What did that mean? Did Elias suspect? Was this whole show only an elaborate setting? For the king to denounce his old comrade and send Guthwulf's head to join the others, that now clustered thick as blackberries atop the Niarulla gate.
"Ah, my king," rasped a familiar voice. "Are you taking a little air? I could wish you a better day for it."
Priorates stood in the curtained archway behind the balcony, teeth bared in a vulpine grin. The priest wore a great hooded cloak over his usual scarlet robe.
"I am glad to see you here," Elias said. "I hope you are rested after your long journey yesterday."
"Yes, Highness. It was an unsettling trip. But a night in my own bed in Hjeldin's tower has done wonders. I am ready to do your bidding."
The priest made a little mock bow. The top of his pale, bald head revealed for a moment, like a new moon, before he straightened and looked to Guthwulf.
"And the Earl of Utanit. Good morning tide to you, Guthwulf. I hear you are riding forth in the king's behalf."
Guthwulf looked at Priorates with cold distaste.
"Against your advice, I am told."
The alchemist shrugged, as if to show that his personal reservations were of little account.
"I do think there are perhaps more important matters with which His Majesty should concern himself than a search for his brother. Joshua's power was broken at Naglimund. I see little need in pursuing him. Like his seed on stony ground, I think he will find no purchase, no place to grow strong. No one would dare flaunt the High King's ward by giving such a renegade shelter."
He shrugged again.
"But I am only a counselor. The king knows his own mind."
Elias, staring down at the quiet assembly in the courtyard below, seemed to have ignored the entire conversation. He rubbed absently at the iron crown on his brow, as though it caused him some discomfort. Guthwulf thought the king's skin had a sickly, transparent look.
"Strange days," Elias said, half to himself. "Strange days."
"Strange days indeed,"
Guthwulf agreed, drawn to reckless conversation.
"Priest, I hear you were in the Sankelen on the very night of the Lector's assassination."
Priorates nodded soberly.
"A ghastly thing. Some mad cult of heretics, I hear. I hope Veligis, the new lector, will soon root them out."
"Renesin will be missed," Guthwulf said slowly. "He was a popular and well-respected man, even among those who do not accept the true faith."
"Yes, he was a powerful man," Priorates said.
His black eyes glinted as he gazed sidelong at the king. Elias still did not look up, but an expression of pain seemed to flit across his pallid features.
"A very powerful man,"
the red priest repeated.
"My people do not seem happy,"
the king murmured, leaning out against the stone railing. The scabbard of his massive double-hilted sword scraped the stone, and Guthwulf suppressed a shudder. The dreams that still haunted him, the dreams of that foul sword and its two brother blades. Priorates moved forward to the king's side. The Earl of Utanit edged away, unwilling to touch even the alchemist's cloak. As he turned, he saw a blur of movement from the archway, billowing curtains, a pale face, a dull glint of exposed metal. An instant later, a howling shriek echoed through the courtyard.
"Murderer!"
Priorates staggered back from the railing, a knife handle standing between his shoulder blades. The next moments passed with dreadful slowness. The lassitude of Guthwulf's movements and the dull, doomed progression of his thoughts made him feel as though he and all the others on the balcony were suddenly immersed in choking, clinging mud. The alchemist turned to face his attacker, a wild-eyed old woman who had been thrown down to the stone floor behind him by the priest's spasmodic reaction. Priorates' lips skinned back from his teeth in a horrible dog-like grin of agony and fury. His naked fist lifted in the air, and a weird grey-yellow glow began to play about it. Smoke seeped from his fingers and around the knife wagging in his back, and for a moment the very light in the sky seemed to dim. Elias had turned as well, his mouth a black hole of surprise in his face, his eyes bulging with a panicky horror such as Guthwulf had never dreamed he would see on the king's face. The woman on the floor was scrabbling at the stone tiles, as if swimming in some thick fluid, trying to drag herself away from the priest. Priorati's black eyes seemed almost to have fallen back into his head. For a moment, a leering scarlet-robed skeleton stood over the old woman, bony hands smoldering into incandescence. Guthwulf never knew what spurred his next action. A commoner had attacked the king's counselor, and the Earl of Utanyit was king's hand. Nevertheless, he found himself suddenly lurching forward. The noise of the crowd, the storm, his own heartbeat, all swelled together into a single hammering pulse as Guthwulf grappled with Priorati's. The priest's spindly form was solid as iron beneath his hands. Priorati's head turned agonizingly slowly. His eyes burned into Guthwulf's. The Earl felt himself abruptly pulled out of his own body and sent spinning down into a dark pit. There was a flash of fire and a blast of incredible heat, as though he had fallen into one of the forge furnaces beneath the great castle. Then a howling blackness took him away. When Guthwulf awakened, he was still in darkness. His body seemed one dull ache of pain. Droplets of moisture pattered lightly on his face, and the smell of wet stone was in his nostrils.
"I did not even see her," a voice was saying.
After a moment, Guthwulf was able to identify it as the king's, although there was a subtle chiming tone to it that he had not marked before.
"By God's head, to think that I have become so slow and preoccupied."
The king's laugh had a fearful tinge.
"I was sure she had come for me."
Guthwulf tried to respond to Elias, but found that he could not form the proper sounds. It was dark, so dark that he could not make out the king's form. He wondered if he had been brought to his own room, and how long he had been senseless.
"I saw her,"
Priorates rasped. His voice, too, had taken on a ringing sound.
"She may have escaped me for a moment, but by the Black Eon, the scrubbing bitch will pay."
Guthwulf, still struggling for speech, found himself amazed that Priorati should be able to speak at all, let alone be standing, while the Earl of Utanyit lay on the ground.
"I suppose now I shall have to wait for Fingbald to return, before I can send out the Erkengard. Or perhaps one of the younger lords could lead them."
The king sighed wearily.
"Poor wolf."
There seemed in his strangely tuneful voice little sympathy.
"He should not have touched me,"
Priorati said contemptuously.
"He interfered, and the slattern escaped. Perhaps he was in league with her."
No, I do not think so. He was always loyal. Always."
"Poor wolf? What, did they think he was dead?" Guthwulf strained to make his muscles work. Had they brought him to some curtained room to lie in waiting for burial? He fought for mastery of his body, but all his limbs seemed coldly unresponsive. A horrible thought came to him suddenly. Perhaps he was dead. For who, after all, had ever returned to say what it was like? Only Osiris himself, and he was the son of God. Oh, merciful Aedhen, would he have to stay trapped in his body like a prisoner in a forgotten cell, even as they laid him in the wormy ground? He felt a scream building within him. Would it be like the dream when he touched the sword? God save him, merciful Aedhen.
"I am going, Elias. I will find her, even if I must crush the stones of the servants' quarters into dust, and flay the skin of every chambermaid."
Priorati spoke with a sort of sweetness, as though the savor of this thought was as splendid as wine.
"I will see that people are punished."
"But surely you should rest,"
Elias said mildly, as though speaking to a forward child.
"Your injury?"
"The pain I inflict on the chamber mistress will take my own pain away,"
the alchemist said shortly.
"I am well. I have grown strong, Elias.
It will take more than a single knife thrust to dispatch me.
Ah, the king's voice was emotionless.
Good. That is good.
Guthwulf heard Priorati's boot heels clocking against the tiled stone floor, striding away. There was no sound of a door opening and closing, but another shower of moisture spattered the Earl of Utanyit's face. This time, he felt the chill of the water.
Lias,
he managed to say at last.
Guthwulf, the king said, gently surprised. You live?
Where?
Where is what?
Me.
You are on the balcony where you had your accident.
How could that be? Had it not been morning time when they had watched the Erkingard muster? Had he lain here lifelessly until evening? Why hadn't they moved him to a more comfortable place?
He's right, you know, Elias was saying. You really shouldn't have interfered. What did you think you were doing?
The odd ringing sound was beginning to fade from his voice.
It was very foolish. I told you to stay away from the priest, didn't I?
Can't see,
Guthwulf managed at last.
I'm not surprised, Elias said calmly. Your face is badly burned, especially around your eyes. They look very bad. I was certain you were dead, but you're not.
The king's voice was distant.
It's a pity, old comrade, but I told you to watch out for Priorates.
Blind?
Guthwulf said, his voice hoarse, throat seizing in a painful spasm.
Blind?
His rasping howl broke across the commons, bouncing from wall to stone wall, until it seemed 100 Guthwulfs were screaming. As he vented his agony, the king patted him on the head, as though soothing an old dog. The river valley waited for the oncoming storm. The chilly air warmed and grew heavy. The Steflot murmured uneasily, and the sky was gravid with angry-looking clouds. The travellers found themselves speaking softly, as if they rode past the sleeping form of some huge beast, who might be awakened by disrespectful loudness or levity. Hotvig and his men had decided to ride back to the rest of their party, who were nearly 40, all told, men, women, and children. Hotvig's clanfolk and their wagons were following as swiftly as they could, but they were no match for the speed of unencumbered riders.
I am still amazed that your people would uproot themselves to follow us into an unknown and ill-omened wilderness,
Joss was said at their parting. Hotvig grinned, showing a gap in his teeth, earned in some past brawl.
A brute? There is no such word. To the folk of the Stallion clan, our roots are in our wagons and our saddles.
But surely your clansmen are worried about riding into such strange territory?
A brief look of concern flickered across the Thrithing's man's face, quickly supplanted by an expression of disdainful pride.
You forget, Prince Joshua, that they are my kinsfolk. I told them, if stone dwellers can ride there without fear, can the people of the Free Thrithings shy away? They follow me.
He pulled at his beard and grinned once more.
Besides, it is worth many risks to get out from under Fekolmage's hand.
And you are sure he will not pursue you? The prince asked.
Hotvig shook his head. As I told you last night, the Marchthane has lost face because of you. Anyway, our clans often split into smaller clan families. It is our right as people of the Free Thrithings. The last thing Fekolmage can do now is to try to keep us few from leaving the greater clan. That would prove beyond doubt that he is losing his hold on the reins.
When they had all gathered around the fire after their encounter in the dark, Hotvig had explained how Fekolmage's treatment of his daughter and Prince Joshua had caused much disgruntled talk around the wagons of the Stallion clan. Fekolmage had never been a popular leader, but he had been respected as a powerful fighter and clever strategist. To see him so bedeviled by the mere presence of stone dwellers, to the point where he would lend aid to Fengbold and others of the High King's men, without consulting his clan chiefs, had made many wonder out loud whether Fecolmage was still capable of lording it, as Marchthane of all of the High Thrivings. When Earl Fengbold had arrived with his 50 or so armored men, swaggering into the wagon camp like conquerors, Hotvig and some of the other Rand warders had brought the men of their own clan families to Fecolmage's wagon. The Marchthane had wished to set the Erkinlanders quickly on the trail of Joshua's party. But Hotvig and the others had stood against their leader.
"No stone dwellers go armed across the Stallion clan's fields without a gathering of chiefs to say they can," Hotvig had cried.
And his fellows had echoed him. Fecolmage had fumed and threatened, but the laws of the Free Thrivings were the only immutable things in the clanfolk's nomadic existence. The argument had ended with Hotvig and the other Rand warders telling Earl Fengbold,
"A foolish, dangerous man who likes himself well,"
as Hotvig described him, that the only way the High King's men could pursue Joshua was to go around the Stallion clan's territory. Fengbold, outnumbered by 10 to 1 or more, had no choice but to ride away, taking the shortest route back off the High Thrivings. The Earl of Falshire had made many angry threats before departing, promising that the Grasslanders' long days of freedom were over, that High King Elias would come soon and knock the wheels off their wagons once and for all. Unsurprisingly, this public thwarting of Fecolmage's authority brought on a terrible argument that several times almost erupted into deadly bloodshed. The disputing ceased only when Hotvig and several other Rand warders took their families and followed Joshua, leaving Fecolmage behind to curse and lick his wounds, his strength as Marchthane weakened, but by no means ended.
"No, he will not follow us," Hotvig repeated. "That would say to all the clans that mighty Fecolmage cannot survive the loss of our few wagons, and that the Stone Dwellers and their feuds are more important to the Marchthane of all the High Thrivings than his own people. Now, we clan exiles will live near you for a while, at your farewell stone, and talk among ourselves about what we will do."
"I cannot tell you how grateful I am for your help," Joshua said solemnly. "You have saved our lives. If Fengbold and his soldiers had caught us, we would be going back to the Hayholt in chains. Then there would be no one to stop my brother." Hotvig looked at him keenly.
"You may think so, but you do not know the strength of the Free Thrivings if you think we would be so easily overcome."
He hefted his long spear.
"Already the men of the Meadow Thrivings are making things very difficult for the Stone Dwellers of Naben."
Father Strangyard, who had been listening carefully, made a worried face.
"The king is not the only one we fear, Hotvig."
The Thrivings man nodded.
"So you told me. And I would hear more. But now I must go back for the rest of my people. If your destination is as close as the woman says,"
he indicated Jaloi with careful respect,
"then look for us before sunset tomorrow. The wagons can go no faster."
"But do not delay,"
the wise woman said.
"I did not speak lightly when I said we must make haste ahead of this storm.
No one can ride like Grasslander horsemen," Hotvig said sternly, "and our wagon teams are not much slower. We will be with you before tomorrow's night."
He laughed, again showing his missing tooth.
"Leave it to city folk to find stone in the middle of the meadowlands, then want to make their home there. Still," he said to the prince, "I knew when you killed Utvart that things would never be the same for anyone. My father taught me to trust my hand and my heart."
He grinned,
my luck, too. I bet one of my foals on you, Joshua, in your fighting with Utvard. My friends were ashamed to best me so easily, but they took my wager. He laughed loudly.
You won 4 good horses for me.
He turned his mount toward the south, waving.
Soon we will meet again.
And no arrows this time, cried Deornoth. Go safely, Joshua called, as Hotvig and his men spurred away across the green lands.
Heartened by the encounter with the Thrithings folk, the travelers rode cheerfully through the morning, despite the threatening skies. When they stopped briefly to take their midday meal and water the horses, Sangfugl even convinced Father Strangyard to sing with him. The priest's surprisingly sweet voice blended well with the harpers, and if Father Strangyard did not quite understand what the Ballad of Round-Heeled Moira was about, his enjoyment was the greater for it, and for the laughing praise given to him after. When they were in the saddle once more, Deornoth found himself riding beside Jaloi, who cradled Leleth before her on the saddle. She rode flawlessly, as one of long experience. Deornoth found himself wondering once more what the wise woman's strange history might be. She was also still wearing the spare clothing he had brought out of the wagon camp, as if she had come to that fateful copse of trees naked. After thinking for a while about why that might be, and remembering the clawed thing that had struck at him in darkness, Deornoth decided that there were some things about which a God-fearing knight should not inquire. "Forgive me, Valada Jaloi," he said, "but you look very grim. Is there something important you have not told us yet?" He indicated Sangfugl and Strangyard, laughing with Duchess Gutrun as they rode. "Are we singing in the lichyard, as the old saying goes?" Jaloi continued to watch the sky. From her lap, Leleth looked at him as though he were an interesting rock.
"I fear many things, Sir Deornoth," Jaloi said at last. "The problem with being a wise woman is that sometimes you know just enough to be truly afraid, while still not having any better answers than might the youngest child. I fear this coming storm, the one who is our true enemy. I will not say his name here, in this land, not in the open. He's reaching the summit of his power. We have already seen in this cold summer how his pride and anger speak in the winds and clouds. Now, black weather is swirling out of the north. I am sure it is his storm. If I am right, it will bring woe to those who resist him."
Deornoth found himself following her gaze. Suddenly, the ominous cloud seemed an inky hand stretching across the sky from the north, blindly but patiently searching. The idea of waiting for that hand to find them sent a poisonous dread twisting through him, so that he had to look down at his saddle for a moment before he could lift his eyes to Jaloi's yellow stare.
"I understand," he said.
Sunlight bled fitfully through chinks in the clouds. The wind turned, blowing into their faces, heavy and moist. As they followed the line of the valley, a broad bend in the Steflod revealed for the first time the old forest, the Aldeorta. The great wood was much nearer than Deornoth would have guessed. The party's return on horseback had been far swifter than their straggling march out across the Thrithings. Because of their descent into the river valley, the forest now stood on the heights above them, a solid line of vegetation like dark cliffs along the valley's northern rim.
"It is not far now," Jaloi said.
They rode on through the afternoon as the curtain sun slid down the sky, glowing behind the grey murk. Another turn in the river's course brought them around a cluster of shallow hills. They stopped short.
"Merciful Aiden," Deornoth breathed to himself. "Seswadra,"
Chiloe said.
There stands the stone of farewell.
That's no stone, Sangfugel said disbelievingly. That's a mountain.
A great hill rose from the valley floor before them. Unlike its low, rounded neighbors, Sesuadra thrust up from the meadows like the head of a buried giant, bearded with trees, crowned with angular stones that stood along the ridgeline. Beyond the spiky stones, some shimmering whiteness lay along the hill's very peak. An immense, upward-straining slab of weathered rock and clinging brush, Sesuadra loomed some 500 cubits above the river. The uneven sunlight washed across the hill in wavering bands, so that the entire mass almost seemed to turn and watch them as they rode slowly down the watercourse.
It is much like Thistleborg, near the Hayholt, Joshua said wonderingly.
That's no stone, Sangfugel repeated stubbornly, shaking his head.
Jaloi laughed harshly.
It is all stone. Sesuadra is a part of the very bones of the earth, thrust free of her body in the pain of the days of fire, but still reaching down into the very center of the world.
Father Strangyard was eyeing the massive hill nervously.
And we are going to stay there? Live there?
The witch woman smiled.
We have permission.
As they neared, it became apparent that the stone was not so sheer as distance made it seem. A path, a lighter streak through the choking trees and brush, snaked its way around the base of the hill, then appeared again farther up, spiraling summitward around the circumference of the rock, until it disappeared near the crest.
How can trees live on such a stone, let alone thrive? Deonarth asked. Can they grow in the very rock?
Sesuadra has been broken and worn over the eons of its existence, Jaloi answered. Plants will ever find their way, and they themselves help to further break the stone until it is crumbled to a dirt scarcely less rich than found on a Huanshir freeholding.
Deonoth frowned slightly at this reference to his birthplace, then wondered how the wise woman knew of his father's farm. He had certainly never mentioned it to her. Soon they were walking in the sudden twilight of the hill's long shadow, whipped by a chilly wind. The path that began at Sesuadra's base lay before them, hugging the hillside, a trampled cut of grass and moss overhung by trees and twining creepers.
And we are going up? Duchess Gutrun asked in some consternation. Up into this place? Of course, Jaloi said, a touch of impatience in her rough voice. It is the highest ground for leagues. We have need of high ground just now. Besides, there are other reasons. Must I explain them all again?
No, Valada Jaloi, please lead us, Joshua said.
The prince seemed fired by some inner flame, his pale face alight with excitement.
This is what we have been searching for. This is where we will begin the long road back.
His face slackened somewhat.
I do wonder, though, how Hotvig and his folk will feel about leaving their wagons below. It is a pity there is no way to get them up the hill.
The wise woman waved her calloused hand.
You worry too soon. Step ahead and you will have a surprise.
They rode forward. Beneath the straggling grass, the path that wound up the hillside was as smooth as one of old Naglemann's hallways, and wide enough for any wagon.
But how can this be?
Joshua asked.
You forget, Jaloi responded. This is a city place. Beneath this bramble is the road they built. It takes many, many centuries to destroy the handiwork of the Zedaya.
Joshua was not cheered.
I am amazed.
But now I am even more worried. What will keep our enemies from climbing as easily as we do?
Jaloi snorted in disgust.
First, It is easier to defend a high place than to take it from below. Secondly, the nature of the place itself is against it. Third, and perhaps most importantly, our enemy's own rage may outsmart him and ensure our survival, at least for a while.
How so? The prince demanded.
You'll see.
Chloe spurred her horse up the path, Leleth bobbing on the saddle before her. The child's wide brown eyes took in everything without any show of feeling. Joshua shrugged and followed. Deyonoth turned to see Vorsheva sitting upright on her horse, face set in lines of grim fear.
"What is it, my lady?" he asked. "Is something amiss?"
She offered a nervous smile.
"My people have hated and feared this valley forever. Hodvig is a clanman and would not show it, but he fears this place too."
She sighed shakily.
"Now I must follow my husband up on this unnatural rock. I am afraid."
For the first time since his prince had brought this odd woman to live in the castle at Naglamund, Deyonoth felt his heart opening to her, filling with admiration. "We are all deathly afraid, my lady," he said. "The rest of us are just not as honest as you." He tapped gently with his heels at Vildelix's ribs and followed Vorsheva up the path. The road was overhung with trailing vines and the tangled branches of trees, forcing the travelers to spend as much time ducking their heads as they did riding upright. As they slowly circled out of the shadow, like ants walking the perimeter of a sundial, the mist that clung to the hill lent an unusual sparkle to the afternoon glow. Deyonar thought that the smell of the place was what seemed strangest of all. Seswadra gave off a scent of timeless growth, of water and roots and damp earth, in a place long undisturbed. There was an air of peace here, of slow, careful thought, but also a disturbing sensation of watchfulness. From time to time, the stillness was broken by the trill of unseen birds, whose songs were as somber and hesitant as children whispering in a high-ceilinged hall. As the grassy meadow began to drop away below them, the travelers passed posts of standing stone, time-smoothed white shapes almost twice a man's height, that had in their unrecognizable outlines some hint of movement, of life. They passed the first as the path brought them around into direct sunlight for the first time.
"Marking pillars," Jaloe called over her shoulder. "One for each of the moons in the year. We'll pass a dozen every time we circle around the hill, until we reach the summit. They were carved to look like animals and birds once, I think."
Deyonoth stared at the rounded knob that might have been a head and wondered what beast it had once represented. Weathered by wind and rain, it was now as shapeless as melted wax, faceless as the forgotten dead. He shivered and made the sign of the tree on his breast. A little while later, Jaloe stopped and pointed downward toward the northwest part of the valley, where the rim of the old forest reached out almost to the very banks of the Steflod. The river was a tiny streak of quicksilver along the valley's emerald floor.
"Just beyond the river," she said. "Do you see?"
She gestured again at the forest's dark breakfront, which might have been a frozen sea wave awaiting only spring's thaw before it swept across the low ground.
"There, in the forest's fringe, those are the ruins of Enki Ishaose, which some say was the most beautiful city ever built in Ostenard since the world began."
As his companions whispered and shaded their eyes, Deyonoth moved to the edge of the path, squinting at the distant forest. He saw nothing but what might have been a crumbled wall of lavender, a flash of gold.
"There's not much to see," he said quietly.
"Not in this age," Jaloe replied.
Up they climbed as the day waned. Each time they circled around to the hill's northern slope, coming out of shade into ever-decreasing afternoon light, they could see the spreading knot of blackness on the horizon. The storm was moving in swiftly. It had now swallowed the far borders of Great Aldeota, so that all the north seemed a grey uncertainty. As they finished their 12th circuit around the hill, passing the 144th of the marking pillars, a small enough diversion, but still Deonoth had kept score, the travellers emerged at last from the shadowing greenery, clambering up a final slope until they stood on the hill's windy summit. The sun had fallen away into the west. Only a reddish sliver remained. The top of the hill was nearly flat and scarcely less wide than Seswadra's base. All around its perimeter jutted fingers of upright stone, not smoothed like the marking pillars, but great raw standing stones, each as tall as four men, made of the same grey rock veined with white and pink that formed the hill. In the centre of the plateau, in the midst of a field of waving grass, stood a vast low building of opalescent stone, tinged with the sunset's red glow. At first it seemed a temple of some sort, like the great old buildings of Naban from the days of the Imperium, but its lines were plainer. Its unassuming but affecting style made it seem almost to spring from the hill itself. It was plain that this structure belonged on this windy hilltop, beneath this incredibly wide sky. The grandeur and self-interest that spoke from every angle of houses of human worship, however finely wrought, was a language alien to whoever had built this. The passage of unguessable years had in places brought its walls to collapse. Unhindered for centuries, trees had thrust up through the building's very roof, or pushed their way in at the arched doorways like unwanted guests. Still, the simplicity and beauty of the place were so plain, and at the same time so inhuman, that for a long time no one ventured to speak. "We are here," Joshua said at last, his tone solemn but exalted. "After all our danger and all our suffering, we have found a place where we can stop and say, we go no farther."
"It is not forever, Prince Joshua,"
Jaloi spoke gently, as if unwilling to break his mood. But the prince was already striding confidently across the hilltop toward the white walls.
"It need not be forever," he called, "but for now, we will be safe."
He turned and waved his hand for the others to follow, then continued turning, gazing around him on all sides.
"I take back what I said," he shouted to Jaloi. "With a few good folk behind me, I could make a stand here, and Sir Camaris himself could not defeat me, not with all the knights of my father's great table at his side."
He bounded away toward the pale walls that now showed a touch of blue. Evening was coming on. The others went after him, talking quietly among themselves, as they passed through the swaying grass. Chapter 25. Petals in a Windstorm.
"It's a stupid game," Simon said. "It doesn't make any sense."
Aditu lifted an eyebrow.
"It doesn't," he insisted. "I mean, look, you could win if you just moved here," he pointed. "And there," he pointed again.
Looking up, he found Aditu's golden eyes upon him, laughing, mocking.
"Couldn't you?" he finished.
"Of course, Xiaomen."
She moved the polished stones across the gaming board, as he had suggested, from one golden island to another, over a sea of sapphire-blue waves. The mock ocean was surrounded by scarlet flames and murky grey clouds.
"But then the game is over, and only the shallowest waters have been explored."
Simon shook his head. He had struggled for days to learn the complex rules of Shent, only to discover that what he had been taught were only the rudiments. How could he learn a game that people did not play to win? But Aditu did not try to lose, either, as far as Simon could tell. Instead, it seemed as though the issue was to make the game interesting by introducing themes and puzzles, most of which were as far beyond Simon's comprehension as the mechanisms of the rainbow.
"If you will not take offense," Aditu said, smiling, "may I instead show you another way?"
She put the markers back in their previous locations.
"If I use these songs of mine to build a bridge here,"
a quick flurry of movements,
"then you can cross to the Isles of the Cloud of Exile."
"But why do you want to help me?" Somewhere, as if in the very fabric of the mutable walls, a stringed instrument began to sound. If Simon had not known that they were quite alone within the airy, nectarine walls of Aditu's house, he would have thought a musician played in the next wind-shifting room. He had stopped wondering about such things, but could not still a reflexive shudder. The music felt eerie and delicate, as a small and excessively legged something walking across his skin. "How can you win a game when you keep helping the other person?" Aditu leaned back from the gaming board. In her own home, she wore just as little as she did on the walkways of Zhao E Tanokai, if not less. Simon, who still could not look comfortably on the abundance of her golden limbs, stared hard at the playing pieces.
"Man-child," she said, "I think you can learn. I think you are learning. But remember, we Zedaya have been playing this game since time before time. First, Grandmother says it came with us from the garden that is lost."
She laid a placatory hand on Simon's arm, raising goosebumps there.
"Shent can be played to amuse only. I have played games that were nothing but gossip and friendly mockery, and all strategies were turned to that end. Other games, one can only win by almost losing. I have also experienced games where both players truly strove to lose, although it took years for one to succeed."
Some memory brought a flick of smile.
"Do you not see, Snorlock, winning and losing are only the walls within which the game takes place. Inside the House of Shent."
She paused, a frown touching her mercurial face like a shadow.
"It is hard to say in your tongue."
The frown disappeared.
"Perhaps that is why it seems so difficult for you. The thing is, within the House of Shent, it is the coming and going, the visitors, friends and enemies both, the births and deaths, all of these things matter."
She jested around her at her own habitation, the floors deep in sweet grass, the rooms tangled with the branches of tiny flowering trees. Some of the trees Simon had discovered had fierce little thorns.
"As with all dwellings," she said, "of mortals and immortals both, it is the living that makes a house, not the doors, not the walls."
She rose and stretched. Simon watched covertly, struggling to keep his frowning mask, even as her graceful movements caused his heart to leap painfully.
"We will continue our play tomorrow," she said. "I think you are learning, although you do not know it yet. Shent has lessons even for Sodhoraya, Sioman."
Simon knew that she was bored, and that it was time for him to leave. He was terribly conscious of never overstaying his welcome. He hated it when the Scythi were kind and understanding with him, as though he were a stupid animal that did not know better. "I should go, Aditu." She did not ask him to stay. Anger and regret and a sort of deep physical frustration all struggled within him as he bowed his head briefly, then turned and made his way out between the swaying blossoms. The afternoon light glowed through the orange and rose walls, as if he moved inside the very heart of a sunset. He stood outside Aditu's house for some time, looking out past the shimmering mist thrown up from the cataract that played beside her doorway. The valley was umber and gold, slashed with the darker green of the tree-covered hills and the bright emerald of tended meadows. To look at Zhao E Tenokai seemed straightforward as sun and rain. Like any other place, it had rocks and plants and trees and houses. But it also had the Scythi, the folk who lived in these houses. And Simon had grown quite sure that he would never understand them. Like the minute and secret life that teemed in the black earth beneath the valley's placid grass, Simon now realized that Zhao E Tenokai was crowded with things beyond his comprehension. He had already found out how little he understood when he had embarked upon an attempt at escape, soon after being sentenced to a lifetime's imprisonment among these gentle captors. He had waited 3 full days after his sentence had been delivered by Shima Onari. Such patience, Simon had felt sure, demonstrated a cold-blooded subtlety of maneuver worthy of the great Camaris. Looking back a fortnight later, such ignorance was already laughable. What had he thought he was doing? On the 4th day of his sentence, in late afternoon, while the prince was away, Simon walked out of Jiriki's house. He crossed the river quickly, but he hoped unobtrusively, clambering over a narrow bridge, then headed back toward the spot where Aditu had first brought him to the valley. The cloth-knotted mural that led to Jiriki's house continued on the river's far side as well, spanning from tree to tree. The section Simon passed seemed to show the survivors of some great disaster, bringing their boats to a new land. The Scythi coming to Austin Art and building great cities, empires in the forests and mountains. There were other details too, signs woven into the tapestry that suggested strife and sorrow had not been left behind in the blighted homeland. But Simon was in too much of a hurry to stop and look closely. After making his way down the river path for some distance, he turned off at last and headed for the heavy undergrowth at the base of the hills, where he hoped to make up in stealth what he lost in time. There were not many Scythi about, but he was certain that any one of them would sound the alarm at the sight of their prisoner travelling toward the boundaries of Zhao E Tenokai. So he slid through the trees as carefully as he could, keeping away from the common paths. Despite the exhilaration of escape, he felt more than a pang of guilt. Jiriki would doubtless suffer some punishment for letting the mortal captive slip away. Still, Simon owed a responsibility to his other friends that outweighed even the multi-millennial laws of the Scythi. No one saw him, or at least no one made an attempt to stop him. By the time several hours had passed, he had moved into what seemed a wilder, less tamed section of the old forest, and was certain he had made his escape. His entire trip with Aditu from the pools to Jiriki's door had taken less than 2 hours. He had now gone easily twice that, straight back along the river. But when Simon crept down from the cover of the thickest vegetation, it was to find himself still in Zhao E Tenokai, albeit in a part he had not yet seen. He stood in the middle of a shadowed, dusky clearing. The trees all around were draped with fine, silky streamers, like spider webs. The afternoon sun set them gleaming, so that the forest seemed wound in a fiery net. In the middle of the clearing, an oval door of moss-matted white wood had been built into the trunk of a huge oak, around which the silk hung so thickly that the tree itself was barely visible. He paused for a moment, wondering what undersized hermit would live here, in a tree on the outskirts of the city. Next to the beautiful rippling folds of Jiriki's house, or the other graceful constructions of Zhao E Tenokai, let alone the living magnificence of the Yasara, this place seemed backward, as though whoever dwelled here hid himself from even the slow pace of the Scythi. But despite its aura of age and isolation, the spider silk house seemed in no way menacing. The clearing was empty and peaceful, comfortable in its unimportance. The air was dusty but pleasant, like the pockets of a beloved aunt. Here the rest of Zhao E Tanukai seemed only a memory of vibrant life. A person could linger here beneath the silk-draped trees, while the very world crumbled away outside. As Simon stood watching the undulating strands, a mourning dove hooted softly. He abruptly remembered his mission. How long had he stood here, staring like a fool? What if the owner of this strange house had come out, or returned from some errand? Then the hue and cry would go up and he would be caught like a rat. Frustrated by this first error in reckoning, Simon hurried back into the forest. He had misjudged his time, that was all. Another hour's hiking would carry him beyond the city's fringe and back through the summer gate. Then, with the hoarded provisions he had quietly stolen from the prince's generous table, he would head due south until he reached the edge of the forest. He might die in the attempt, but that was what heroes did. This he knew. Simon's willingness to become a dead hero seemed to have little effect on the subtleties of Zhao E Tanukai. When he emerged at last from the dense brush, the sun now far across the sky toward evening, it was to find himself up to his knees in the golden grass of open woodland before the mighty Yasira, where he stood dumbstruck before the shimmering, shifting wings of the butterflies. How could this be? He had followed the river carefully. It had never been out of his sight for more than a few steps, and always it had flowed in the same direction. The sun had seemed to move correctly across the sky. His journey into this place with Aditu would be printed on his heart forever. He could not forget a single detail. But nevertheless, he had walked more than half the afternoon to travel a distance of a few hundred paces. With this realization, the strength flowed from his body. He fell to the warm, damp ground and lay with his face against the turf, as though he had been struck a blow. Jiriki's house had many rooms, one of which he had given to Simon to be his own, but the prince seemed to spend most of his own time in the open-sided chamber where Simon had first met him on arriving in Zhao E Tanukai. As the earliest weeks of his confinement passed, it became Simon's habit to spend each evening there with Jiriki, sitting on the gentle slope above the water, while the light gradually dimmed from the sky, watching the shadows lengthen and the glassy pond grow darker. As the last gleam of the sunset vanished from between the branches, the pond became a somber mirror, stars blooming in its violet depths. Simon had never really listened to the sounds of oncoming night, but Jiriki's often silent company encouraged him to give ear to the songs of cricket and frog, to begin to hear the sighing of wind in the trees as something other than a warning to pull his hat down tightly over his ears. At times, as he sank into the swelling evening, he felt he was on the verge of some great understanding. A sense of being more than himself stole over him, of what it felt like to live in a world that cared little for cities or castles or the worries of the folk who built them. Sometimes, he was frightened by the size of this world, by the limitless depths of the evening sky salted with cold stars. But for all these unfamiliar insights, he still remained Simon. Most of the time, he was merely frustrated. Surely he didn't mean it. He licked the juice of a just-devoured pear from his fingers, then peevishly flung the core across the grassy verge. Beside him, Jiriki was toying with the stem that remained from his own. This was Simon's 15th evening in Zhao E Tanukai, or was it the 16th? Stay here until I die? That's madness! He had not, of course, told Jiriki of his failed attempt at escape, but neither could he pretend to be satisfied with his captivity. Jiriki made what Simon had come to recognize as an unhappy face, a subtle thinning of the lips, a hooding of his upturned feline eyes.
They are my parents, the Scyther said. They are Shimaonari and Likimeia, lords of the Zedaya, and what they decide is as unchangeable as the Wheel of Seasons.
But then why did you bring me here? You broke that rule.
There was no rule to break. Not truly.
Jariki twitched the stem once more between his long fingers, then flicked it into the pond. A tiny circle spread to show where it had fallen.
It was always an unspoken law. But that is different than a word of command. It is traditional among the Dawn children that we may do what we please, unless it goes against a word of command. But this business of bringing a mortal here cuts to the heart of the things that have divided our people since time out of mind. I can only ask you to forgive me, Seoman. It was a risk, and they had no right to gamble with your life. However, I have come to believe that for once, and hear me only this once, you mortals may be right, and my folk may be wrong. This spreading winter threatens many things, beside the kingdoms of the Sodoraya.
Simon lay back, staring up at the brightening stars. He tried to smother the feeling of desperation that rose inside him.
Might your parents change their minds?
They might, Jariki said slowly. They are wise, and would be kind if they could. But do not let your hopes rise too high. We Zedaya never hasten to decisions, especially difficult ones. What might seem to them a reasonable time to ponder could be years, and such waiting is hard for mortals to bear.
Years?
Simon was horrified. He suddenly understood the beast that would gnaw off its own leg to escape a trap.
Years?
I am sorry, Seoman.
Jariki's voice was hoarse, as though with great pain, but his golden features still showed little emotion.
There is one hopeful sign, but do not read too much into it. The butterflies remain.
What?
At the Yasera. They gather when great decisions are to be made. They have not flown, so there are things still unresolved.
What things?
Despite Jariki's warning, Simon felt a surge of hope.
I do not know.
He shook his head.
Now is the time for me to stay away. At this moment, I am not my father's and mother's favorite voice, so I must wait before I go to them again to make my arguments. Fortunately, First Grandmother Amarasu seems to have concerns about my parents' actions. My father's, especially.
He smiled wryly.
Her words carry great weight.
Amarasu?
Simon knew that name. He inhaled deeply of the night. Suddenly it came back to him. A face more beautiful and yet undeniably more ancient than even those of Jariki's ageless parents. Simon sat up.
Do you know, Jariki? I saw her face once in the mirror. Amarasu, the one you call First Grandmother.
In the mirror? In the dragon scale mirror?
Simon nodded. I know I wasn't supposed to use it unless I was calling for your help. But what happened?
It was an accident.
He proceeded to describe his strange encounter with Amarasu and the terrifying appearance of silver-masked Otuku. Jariki seemed to have entirely forgotten the crickets, despite the splendor of their song.
I did not forbid you to use the mirror, Seoman, he said. What is surprising is that you were able to see anything but natural reflection. That is odd.
He made an unfamiliar gesture with his hand.
I must talk to First Grandmother about this. Very odd. May I come? Simon asked.
No, Seomen Snowlock,
Jariki smiled.
No one goes to see Amarasu the Shipborn without her invitation. Even Root and Bao, what you would call her nearest kin, must ask very respectfully for such a favor. You do not know how astonishing it is that you saw her in my mirror. You are a menace, man-child.
A menace? Me? The Sither laughed.
Your presence is what I refer to.
He touched Simon lightly on the shoulder.
You are without precedent, Snowlock, completely unknown and unforeseen.
He rose.
I will move on this. I am anxious myself for something to do.
Simon, who had never been good at waiting, was left alone with the pond, the crickets, and the unreachable stars. It all seemed so strange. One moment he had been fighting for his life, perhaps even for the survival of all Ostenard, struggling against bone weariness and dark magic and terrible odds. A moment later he had been snatched out of winter and dropped headlong into summer, out of hideous danger and into boredom. But Simon realized it was not even so simple as that. Just because he had been removed from the world did not mean that the problems he had left behind were solved. On the contrary, somewhere out there, living or dead in the snowy woods beyond Zhao E Tenukai, was his horse Homefinder and its terrible burden, the sword Thorn, for which Simon and his friends had crossed hundreds of leagues and shed precious blood. Men and Scythi alike had died to find that blade for Joshua. Now, with the sword perhaps lost in the forest, Simon had been imprisoned as offhandedly as Rachel had once locked him in one of the Hayholt's dark pantries for some trifling misdeed. Simon had told Jariki about the lost sword, but the Scyther had only shrugged, infuriatingly placid. There was nothing to be done. Simon looked up. He had wandered far up the riverbank in the stillness of early afternoon. Jariki's house, with its tapestry of knots, had fallen out of sight behind him. He sat down on a stone and watched a white egret stilt out into one of the river's shallow backwaters. Bright eyes staring obliquely, pretending disinterest to allay the fears of any wary fish. He was sure that at least 3 weeks had passed since he had come to the valley. For the last few days, his imprisonment had seemed almost a sort of terribly dull joke, one that had gone on too long, and now threatened to spoil everyone's enjoyment.
What can I do?
In frustration, he scrabbled up a twig from the dirt and sent it spinning out onto the water.
There's no way to leave.
Thinking back on the grand failure of his first escape, and the other confirming experiments that had followed, Simon made a noise of disgust and threw another twig out onto the river. Every attempt to find his way out had left him back in the center of Zhao E Tenukai.
How could I have been such a moon calf? He thought sourly.
Why should I think it would be so easy to walk away from here when Aditu and I had to walk clear out of winter to arrive? The stick whirled for a moment, spinning like a weather vane, then was sucked under by the gentle current.
That's me, he thought. That's what I'll be like, as far as these Scythi folk are concerned. I'll be around for a little while. Then, before they even realize I'm getting old, I'll be dead.
The thought brought a lump of terror into his throat. Suddenly he wanted nothing more than to be around his own short-lived kind. Even Rachel the dragon, rather than these soft-spoken, cat-eyed immortals. Filled with restlessness, he sprang up from the riverbank, kicking his way through the reeds as he pushed back toward the path. He almost bumped into someone, a Scyther man, dressed only in a pair of thin, loose-fitting blue breeches.
who stood in the undergrowth and gazed out toward the river. For a moment, Simon thought this stranger had been spying on him, but the fine, boned face showed no expression at Simon's approach. The Scyther continued to stare out past him as the youth walked by. The stranger was singing quietly to himself, a breathy melody of sibilances and pauses. His attention was fixed on a tree growing out of the riverbank, half submerged in the current. Simon could not restrain a grunt of irritation. What was wrong with these people? They wandered around like sleepwalkers, said things that made no sense. Even Jiriki sometimes talked mysterious, circular nonsense. And the prince was by far the most direct of his tribe, and they all looked at Simon as though he were an insect, when they bothered to notice him at all. Several times, Simon had encountered Sidhi, who he was certain were Kiyushapo and Sijandi, the pair who had accompanied Jiriki and Simon's company north from the Aldeota to the base of Ormsheim. But the Scythi showed no recognition, made no sign of greeting. Simon could not swear beyond any doubt that the faces were theirs, but something in the way they steadfastly avoided his eye assured him that he was correct. After the journey across the northern waste, both Jiriki's kinsman Anne and the Erkinlandish soldier Grimrik had died on the dragon mountain Ornsheim, beneath the icy waterfall known as the Uden Tree. They had been buried together, mortal and immortal, something which Jiriki has said was unprecedented, a binding between their two races unknown for centuries. Now Simon, a mortal, had come to forbidden Zhao E Tanukai. Kiyushapo and Sijandi might not approve of his being there, but they knew he had saved their prince Jiriki. And they knew Simon was Hikastaja, an arrow-bearer. So why should they avoid him so completely? If Simon was wrong in his identification, it should still be simple enough for the real pair to seek him out, since he was the only one of his kind among their folk. Were they so angry at his being here that they could not even greet him? Were they in some way embarrassed for Jiriki, that the prince should have brought such a creature to their secret valley? Then why did they not say so, or say something? At least Jiriki's uncle, Kendra Jaharo, made his dislike of mortals plain and public. Thinking of these slights put Simon in a foul humor.